information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
We care. Here to border on shows.
The law.
The country.
You will remember nine you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Don't be evil, just be corporate. Fool the world with all your own importance. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 206 from Media Monarchy. It's February 18th, 2011. My name's James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups this week, dark origins, food freeze, and Jeopardy's machines, Aurora Alert, Solar Sunshot, Tweetbot, Kids Burn, Arcade Fire, and Curveball Liar, Serene, Laura, Ray, and the Killer Cubicle, Military Rape, Mexicursions, and Port Nukes, plus Bombs, Budgets, Borders, and Bankrupt Boundaries. All that, so much more, episode 206, February 18th, 2011, from MediaMonarchy.com.
The point of no return. The sickles and the
The final track from the latest record from Manic Street Preachers. The album is called Postcards from a Young Man, and that song is called Don't Be Evil. That'll set the stage for this episode 206 from Media Monarchy. Ladies and gentlemen, it's February 18th, 2011. And my name's James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com, broadcasting live, as always, Friday mornings, 10 a.m. Pacific time on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. And a huge thanks to the affiliates who help syndicate and spread the word about this show, ZeroPointRadio.com, simulcast worldwide, as well in Casper, Wyoming on 92.3 FM and 1670 AM. And thanks to the worldwide home of free speech, RevereRadio.net, also simulcasting live this episode 206, MediaMonarchy.com for you. Also thanks to Free Radio Olympia, Berkeley Liberation Radio, One Sky Radio, Patriot Radio, Ground Zero Radio, KBOO.info, Radio23.org, TragedyandHope.com, and all the other sites, and all the folks out there who, again, help spread this out and inform the show, and thank you. We're on all the social network sites, Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, YouTube, Ustream, Blip, Cafe Press, Podomatic, and importantly, you can get in touch with me, MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. Our username is Media Monarchy on Skype and Instant Messenger. We're on iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org. And this is where I ask you, if you find the show valuable, to please support. There's the donate button at the top right of the page. No donors to mention this past week. So I want to throw out the call again to help keep this going and keep those bills paid as the P.O. Box bill is due again. And I'll remind you, and again, that's on the top of the page, P.O. Box 12165, Portland, Oregon 97212. And of course, all the other things that your support supports. If we look at the news on this February 18th morning, of course, there is much going on around the world as we see Bahrain troops open fire on demonstrators. From Libya to Yemen, no sign of Mideast unrest easing. And of course, there is unrest as the Wisconsin Union Bill nears a vote. Lots of bread and circus, lots of shows, lots of psychological operations going on, but what's... I felt a tremor in the force. That's right. The Obamasiah is here in Oregon. Hosanna. And why is he here? He's here to talk to all the small business owners who really make it... Oh, wait, I'm sorry. He's going to Intel in Hillsboro, which is a Portland suburb, and what's he doing there? U.S. President Barack Obama has tapped the chief executive officer of the world's largest semiconductor chip maker, Intel Corp., to join his new Economic Advisory Council. The White House announced Friday that Paul Ottolini will be named to Council on Jobs and Competitiveness. Obama will announce Ottolini's appointment on Friday as he travels to Oregon and tours Intel's semiconductor manufacturing facility. Can't you feel the excitement? Fortunately, the weather turned dreary, so maybe it can rain on the Savior's parade just a little bit. We'll, of course, keep an eye on the breaking news, because, of course, things have a habit of exploding on these Friday afternoons and mornings when we're doing these shows for you. And I believe that's all our housekeeping to take care of. I always want to remind you, just a little bit before this live episode began, I also recorded a B-side episode 205 where we go over all the things in the Media Monarchy Kingdom from all the new sites and all the fantastic alternative media outlets that I am proud enough to be in some way connected to. That would be NewWorldNextWeek.com and CorbettReport.com, PeaceRevolution.org, GroundZeroMedia.org. And we went through everything on some of my other sites, Holy Hexes, Food World Order, and Cyberspace War. But we did cherry pick a few choice bits from some of those sites, and that's how we're going to begin before we even get to the content on Media Monarchy. So we'll start on my newest venture, holyhexes.com, with a quick blip from National Petroleum Radio. And of course, last Monday was Valentine's Day, so we want to just remind you of the dark origins of St. Valentine's Day. A time to celebrate romance and love and kissy face fealty, but the origins of this festival of candy and cupids are actually dark, bloody, and a bit muddled. Though no one has pinpointed the exact origin of the holiday, one good place to start is ancient Rome, where men hit on women by, well, hitting them. From February 13th to 15th, the Romans celebrated the feast of Lupercalia. L-U-P-E-R-C-A-L-I-A, Luper, meaning wolf, she-wolf. The men sacrificed a goat and a dog, then whipped women with the hides of the animals they had just slain. The Roman romantics were drunk, they were naked, says Noel Linsky, historian at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Young women would actually line up for the men to hit them. They believed this would make them fertile. The dark origins of St. Valentine's Day for you on holyhexes.com. And we move to foodworldorder.com with a story from End of the American Dream. Worst freeze in 60 years wipes out crops across U.S. and Mexico border. Get ready to pay a hell of a lot more for produce at the supermarket. In early February, the worst freeze in 60 years wiped out entire crops all across the southwestern U.S. and northern Mexico. Already, it's been reported that some U.S. supermarkets have doubled or even tripled prices for certain produce items. Yes, doubling, tripling. The really bizarre weather that we've been seeing all over the globe this winter is really playing havoc with food prices. The global price of food hit an all-time record during the month of January, and most observers expect food prices to continue to soar. Even before this recent horrible freeze in the southwestern U.S., global food prices were pushed higher by unprecedented flooding in Australia and Brazil, and key agricultural areas of China are now experiencing their worst droughts in 200 years. Things are getting really crazy out there. Produce prices in the U.S. are eventually expected to return back to normal levels, but this just shows how dramatically food prices can change when a major disaster happens. Most Americans assume that the United States is generally immune to food price shocks, so this recent freeze is going to shake a lot of people up. A whole lot of Americans are going to be really surprised the next time they go shopping for fresh produce. For example, at one supermarket in Portland, Oregon, they've been forced to double or even triple the prices on many produce items as a result of this recent freeze. Now, longtime listeners know I do work at a grocery store in Portland, Oregon. But it's not at the Food for Less, which is where this clip is mostly set, and we grabbed this from one of our local news outlets, and I threw it up to youtube.com/mediamonarchy. Produce prices skyrocket with the freeze in Mexico.
Hello, I'm Joe Donlin.
And I'm Tracy Berry. First at 6 tonight, get ready to pay double, maybe even triple the price for fresh produce in the coming weeks. The worst freeze in 60 years has decimated crops in Mexico and the southwestern U.S. News Channel 8's Wayne Haverly is looking into produce prices that seem to be rising by the hour, Wayne.
Yeah, not only are these prices skyrocketing, there is a very good chance that supplies of items like these Roma tomatoes and asparagus might not be available at any price, at least for a while.
What's going on with produce prices?
We've had to double and triple them, and the consumer comes in here and looks at the price. It's a little shock to them.
The problem started less than a week ago when our nation was focusing on the Super Bowl and those sheets of ice falling from Texas Stadium. Farmers throughout northern Mexico and the southwestern U.S. experienced unprecedented crop losses. Now devastation that seems so far away is impacting all of us.
Increase, increase, increase.
Roma tomatoes have more than doubled in price since Thursday. Zucchini has tripled. Shoppers like Sylvia Armenta can't believe what she sees.
Because my money is not doubled and not tripled, you know. I need to buy everything for my son and my baby and my husband. And
these are just current price changes that just come through today.
produce manager Troy Winterhalter's laptop has been lighting up with price increases from wholesalers.
Peppers, zucchini, cucumbers, asparagus. The whole asparagus field pretty much wiped out with the freeze down in Mexico.
About the only items not impacted by the freeze in the coming weeks will be things grown here in the Northwest, like potatoes, onions, and apples.
Situation is so dire, some stores can't honor certain advertised prices, which were ordered in newspapers long before the freeze.
And now I'm in a situation where I can't really support that ad. And I try to do the best I can as far as letting my consumer know what's going on in the market.
I've never seen this happen. I've been in the business for 25, 26 years.
Well, produce wholesalers and shippers, they say this is really probably just the tip of the iceberg. Yes, iceberg lettuce prices already on the rise. And don't expect to see any of these prices lower
until the end of March. There are so many interesting things within that clip. So, again, go to youtube.com/MediaMonarchy and watch the clip again. There's just lots of interesting little nuggets in there. Just like the guy referring to people as his consumers. The other guy's last name being Winterhalter. The fact that they mention, oh, you know, it seems like the only way around this is if we just use things that we actually grow here ourselves. Things grown here in the Pacific Northwest. Potatoes, onions, and apples. It makes a nice soup. And what else is in there? Oh, being distracted by sports spectacles. When everybody was paying attention to the Super Bowl, I like all those little interesting nuggets within a little 2-minute and 23-second news blip. We do have, of course, related updates on this story posted below from Bloomberg. The next crisis is scary food for thought. But we'll flesh out this freeze story with something from Food Freedom. And it's basically a press release, and the PDF you can download, thanks to stevequayle.com, comes from the Sysco Corporation, S-Y-S-C-O. That would be the massive food service supplier. If you've ever worked at a restaurant or just paid attention, you've seen their trucks rolling all around the country. From their own press release, February 8th, all of our growers have invoked the Act of God clause on our contracts. Force majeure due to the following release. The extreme freezing temperatures hit a very broad section of major growing regions in Mexico, from Hermosillo in the north all the way south to Los Mochis and even south still. The early reports still coming in, but most showing losses of crops in the range of 80 to 100%. Some of the updates also below this come from naturalnews.com. Meanwhile, amid this, Mexico rejects Monsanto's GMO corn. Again, coming from Natural News, and we've mentioned repeatedly, when you see ravaged nations still turning down genetically modified food, that should tell you something. Furthermore, from theintelhub.com, a great site, more confirmation, the coming food and financial crisis of 2011 set to wreak havoc, as all of these things are connected. Just as the name of the last Sunday update from corporatereport.com, everything is related. The last update posted along here on the freeze, food freeze story comes from farmwars.info, a handy little food bank locator. So it's fascinating to see as things wobble what becomes more necessary. And we've discussed the massive influx of food banks around the country. And we'll also remind you, we did interview Barbara Peterson of farmwars.info back in the interview archives from Media Monarchy. So we did Holy Hexes and we did Food World Order, but let's get a few posts from cyberspacewar.com. Aurora Alert, so far easily the year's largest solar flare, a category M6.6 solar flare earthbound, essentially as we speak. We don't know if the effects have subsided at all. A Skywatcher alert issued for auroras in possibly lower as well as higher latitudes. Experts agree a cloud of radiation from a coronal mass ejection, CME, coronal mass ejection, solar flare, will hit the Earth's magnetic field on or about February 15th. The source of the activity is sunspot 1158, which is expected to grow. Amazing images of the northern lights and around Norway. They are unbelievable photos. These are the kind of photos that you look at and say, surely that's a Photoshop. But the updates surrounding this, solar flare, jams radio, and satellite signals, that coming from news.com.au out of Australia. GodDiscussion.com reporting on this largest solar flare in 4 years could disrupt power grids and satellite communications. Meanwhile, Cryptogon.com breaks down the scam of the Department of Energy spending supposedly $27 million on a quote-unquote sunshot, which is kind of a play on Kennedy's moonshot. It's an energy idea. We're not launching off to the sun. The last note, as long as we're in outer space, from the Associated Press, Japan may send humanoid tweet bot to space. Lonely astronauts on the International Space Station may soon be getting an android friend from Japan. And for the folks back home, it will tweet. Japan's space agency is considering putting a talking humanoid robot on the International Space Station to watch the mission while astronauts are asleep, monitor their health and stress levels, and communicate to Earth through the microblogging site Twitter. Japan's space agency JAXA announced this week that it's looking to plan to send a humanoid robot to the space station in 2013. Communicate with the ground through Twitter, primarily feeding photos rather than original ideas, and provide astronauts with comfort and companionship. Tying along with the Aurora Alert and the space events that we see reverberate here to the very terra firma, noctilucent clouds. Also a originally rare event, now becoming all the more common, just as the auroras are, as far as where they are generally seen in the past and where they're being seen now, spreading out massively. So the auroras and the noctilucent clouds and the coronal mass ejections. We referenced last week, what do we do if they try and shut the internet down? Well, if there's some sort of catalyzing catastrophic event, they may knock the power out, in which case the internet, it's not going to matter. Our last piece from Cyberspace War is the third story we cover on the most recent episode of NewWorldNextWeek.com, Man versus Machine, the final solutions company destroying humans again. The article I now have posted up is actually written by John C. Dvorak of the No Agenda show, the buzzkill of the crackpot and buzzkill duo of Adam Curry and John Dvorak. When Watson failed to answer the final Jeopardy question correctly during the Tuesday Day 2 Jeopardy game show, yet still won the round, Dvorak here realized his previous letter, or column rather, predicting that the humans would be victorious was wrong. What we're talking about here is IBM International Business Machines, they of the Hollerith punch cards and automating the Holocaust, IBM and the Holocaust.com. They had a little stunt this past week. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, they ran the IBM Challenge, where two of the champs of the show went up against this computer. However, continuing in this article, one of the main sticking points, or at least to this writer, while there's no doubt that this machine is a fantastic accomplishment, as James Corbett said on New World Next Week, the Jeopardy competition is skewed in favor of the Watson's fast buzzer clicker. You could clearly see the two men pushing their buzzers once the question was read, but the giant computer was getting the question electronically and could react faster than the other contestants. It's not like the other guys don't know the answers to these weird questions. we have a couple of clips on this story, and again, it's an interesting one that by no means am I against this. But it's what we try and do with this show is to give you the subtext of some of the players and the names and the acronyms that are involved in these stories that literally make up the story of the week. They are our stories. They're there when you click on the television. It's there all the time. So if we can break through that and add a little more data and wisdom and knowledge to that area, we can not be so pinballed around by all these things that we see. I should have brought some Kraftwerk music. Man versus machine, as the final solutions company is destroying humans again.
This is Jeopardy!
It's the ultimate Jeopardy square-off. The top money winner in Jeopardy history, Brad Rutter, and the record holder for consecutive matches won, Ken Jennings, taking on an IBM computer named Watson.
Watson?
What is Sauron?
Sauron is right.
Named for IBM's founder, Watson is a megamind of 10 refrigerator-sized computer racks running at a speed of 80 trillion operations a second. But this is far beyond Google. Watson understands language the way we speak it. The difference between bat and bat, for instance. It analyzes the equivalent of a million books and whittles down hundreds of likely answers to the best one.
Understanding human language, being able to get into the nuance or the implicit nature of it, the ambiguity, is actually a very, very hard problem.
The scientists here have filled Watson with so much information, it would take the typical human being 250,000 years to learn as much. But as the competition has proven so far, that makes Watson smart, not perfect.
Ken. What are the 20s?
No. Watson.
What is 1920s?
No, Ken said that.
After the first of three nights, Watson was tied for the lead with Rutter and far ahead of Ken Jennings.
I sort of felt like I wanted to win as badly here as I ever have before at anything. This is like the dignity of the species.
But fear not, say the inventors. Machines won't make us obsolete.
The kind of response that a human has to music or to art, to a computer, it's frequencies and amplitudes. It can learn to analyze it, but it can't feel.
Meaning Watson may rival the human brain, but never the human heart. Jim Axelrod, CBS News, Yorktown Heights, New York.
Well, we just seen history made here on KXAN this afternoon. Watson, the supercomputer, wiping the floor with the two greatest human champions ever to play Jeopardy. Watson was primarily developed at IBM's Austin site.
And IBM had consulting help from a team of UT scientists. Well, today they gathered at a watch party to celebrate Watson's success, and that's where KXAN's David Scott joins us now from with more on this epic battle of men versus machine. David.
And celebrate they did. You know, it's much tougher to teach a supercomputer to play Jeopardy than it is to teach it to play chess. Jeopardy is tough. The questions are tricky, the language is ambiguous, and the topics are far-ranging. So how did a machine beat the two greatest Jeopardy players ever? It's elementary, my dear Watson.
Watson.
What is Chew?
You are right. You get to pick.
Literary character, APB, for 800.
Answer, the Daily Double.
Watson is a supercomputer 4 years in the making, stuffed with data. But he also has the ability to reason how likely his answer is correct.
From that, it comes to a final decision, and it rates its uncertainty of actually showing on the show, here's my answer and here's my confidence in those answers. And then if its confidence is high enough in one of the answers, by the time the light goes on, it buzzes in and has it.
Seems to have a split personality.
Who is Hyde?
Hyde, yes, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, either one acceptable. You're now in the lead with 1,400.
Watson practiced with nearly a 250,000 questions from previous Jeopardy seasons to understand the game and develop a way of reasoning not unlike the way we reason, sort of.
It's a lot fuzzier than that. We don't exactly know everything about reasoning. So in some senses, I think Watson is reasoning, maybe not in the traditional way that logicians think.
Watson.
What is Glass Judgment?
Correct. Go again.
Beatles People for 400.
It's very tricky, you know. The questions are not set up to help the humans answer them. Yep. They're set up to make them even more difficult for humans.
Watson.
Who is Jean Valjean?
Correct.
Olympic oddities for 600.
Jeopardy is a devious human game without the strict rules of something more manageable, like chess.
Language understanding is a very difficult problem. There's ambiguity. There's other things that come in that make the Jeopardy challenge much more interesting and challenging from an artificial intelligence point of view than the chess Deep Blue problem was.
Watson?
What is Sauron?
Sauron is right, and that puts you into a tie for the lead with Brad.
Today it was all smiles for the IBM and UT scientists who created Watson. It was no elementary piece of work. And now their baby is the new champ of Jeopardy.
Well, in the future, there will be other applications for Watson's type of technology. It could transform business and society. You get instant ready answers and expertise in the fields of law, medicine, engineering, just about anything you can think of. And besides, Watson's always got a pleasant disposition. At IBM in North Austin, David Scott, KXAN Austin News.
Now, aside from the muddling of the references there, saying, oh, it's elementary, dear Watson. That's, of course, the Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes' sidekick. We're talking about Watson, the eugenicist founder of International Business Machines. Now, an interesting side bit to this from CNET News, their original report, and they still have it up with a correction that we'll get to in just a moment. I can look at it right now, the screen grab of a conversation, a little chat room going on as these shows were running, where someone asked one of the programmers, Michael, saw the taping, but I didn't. Did Watson crash? That's the question. Michael Bick says, yes, he crashed a bunch of times. It took over 4 hours to tape the show. Most of the delays were due to crashes. So that's plainly this person asking, did Watson crash? So, of course, the inevitable backpedaling came, the correction. After this story was published, we heard from PBS producer Michael Bix that it was not, in fact, Watson that crashed during the show's taping. He would like to make clear the following, quote, I misblogged last night. It was not Watson, but the system that was the interface between Watson and the Jeopardy computer, completely separate from Watson that crashed during the taping. So, whether it did or it didn't, this story, with all its fascinating facets, and we do have, of course, all the supplemental links going around to the Associated Press and the Los Angeles Times and the Wall Street Journal and PC Mag, and even the updates on ultimately, and you heard one of those clips, when Watson won on day 3. Machines beat us at our own game. I think the last thing I was going to mention that my girlfriend reminded me that this was kind of like the Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn film called Desk Set. That's kind of a holiday romantic comedy, but it's essentially about the reference desk at, I think, what is never exactly named, but it's basically a large media outlet within Rockefeller Center. And these women are the who the shows and all the things call of, you know, for fact-checking. Spencer Tracy comes in and starts to bust out the measuring tape because he's an efficiency expert, and he's going to bring in these new machines from International Business Machines to make this place a lot more efficient. So, of course, Spencer and Hepburn fall in love, and they bring in the big machines, and of course they fall apart, and it's very comical as they spew steam, and mainframes and tape reels fly around, and ultimately the heart wins in that story. But it is a fascinating bit set in Rockefeller Center, and the film even opens with a nice title card, you know, produced, you know, with the great assistance of International Business Machines. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's all our other related alternative media in the media monarchy kingdom, from Food World Order and Cyberspace War and Holy Hexes. We're now going to turn for the remainder of this episode 206 to the homepage of MediaMonarchy.com, where we'll begin with the news purge, the ugly list of headlines that we'll blast through, and we have tons of clips and tons of related ephemera for you as we, and I think I've taken this on and I like this. A listener contacted me and in talking about the show said that maybe my role is that I tell the story of the week. So I kind of like that. I may kind of work that line in. We're telling the story of the week, sometimes all out of order. Sometimes we miss parts. Of course, so many times I get home and I'm putting the show up and remember, I didn't make the connection of this one thing. I meant to tie in something else. So much to put into. And then again, that's why this is all a two-way street and your contact and help is very, very necessary to say the very least. Our news purge is named Don't Be Evil, Just Be Corporate. And that was our opening track from the Manic Street Preachers. We start alphabetically, or numerically in this case, with the 9/11 updates. And we'll start it with just a couple of bits of 9/11 updates. The New York Times reporting that 9/11 memorial access will be limited. For years after the 9/11 memorial opens this fall, access will be limited, the president of the Memorial Foundation said on Monday. Ultimately, visitors will be able to approach the memorial and its green spaces and cobblestone plazas from all sides. But for years, said Joe Daniels, the president of the National September 11th Memorial Museum, the memorial will be surrounded by the construction sites of skyscrapers and a transit hub, and visitors will only be able to use one entrance. The 1,776-foot One World Trade Center, formerly known as the Freedom Tower, is being built just northwest of the memorial site and will not open until 2013. Hundreds of trees will still need to be planted on the 8-acre memorial plaza after 9/11 this year, the 10th anniversary. And on, the transit hub won't be completed until 2015. But this is one of those stories that I thought just, even in its title, shows you, we're going to build these things for you, but your access will be limited. Our other 9/11 update, a response to Bill Moyers. Journalist bashes 9/11 truth, yet goes on to say that facts matter in a recent speech in New York. So we've got two reactions to this from Disquiet Reservations and 911blogger.com. And Bill Moyers is one of those guys where you can say, oh, he did, you know, those great documentaries about, now the names escape me, the secret government. But he's talking about myths. And he should know. But let's move to our BioWars EnviroHealth updates. The Deutsche Press Agency reporting U.S. greenhouse gas emissions at lowest level since 1995. A weak economy has driven U.S. emissions of greenhouse gases to their lowest level since 1995, according to the EPA, EPA. U.S. emissions of heat-trapping gases blamed for global warming already fell in 2008, the first year of a deep U.S. recession, after emissions had peaked in 2007. The EPA's figures will be submitted to the United Nations after the U.S. public is given 30 days to comment on the report. I don't know that I need 30 days. It seems interesting that the controlled demolition of the fake economy built on zeros and ones and fiat money and elite banksters is playing in to the environmental propaganda. So if we can't shame you into it, we'll just destroy the middle class, and many of you will play along, ponying up your heart and dough to the Rothschilds and all the other cronies collecting in on the carbon taxes. So let's put the next story in, also from the Deutsche Press Agency. Studies link heavy rains and floods that we've seen recently to global warming. But I thought greenhouse gas emissions are at their lowest levels in 16 years. My stomach hurts. I'm holding two opposed points. My cognitive infiltrationness. Further on the BioWars EnviroHealth update, Chevron ordered to pay $9 billion for their Ecuador pollution. Arkansas cities feel unexplained surge in earthquakes, and we're seeing those all around. We have to ask the question if all of the strange earth events, as well as the mass animal die-offs, are related in some way to some impending event. Meanwhile, back here in the Pacific Northwest, as we've had massive earthquakes off the coast, tens of thousands of them in small numbers and small scales, volcanic Valentine replays 81 quake near Mount St. Helens. An event 30 years to the day on Valentine's Day. But meanwhile, let's go on a field trip where Louisiana students' mystery field trip, Skinburn.
Students come home in the middle of February with what looks like a sunburn. Now parents and teachers want to know how it happened. KTC Sean Klein was in Hathaway tonight looking for answers to that burning question.
A mystery in the community of Hathaway, and it has people burning to know the answers.
Don't know what caused it.
We just kept trying to find answers.
About two dozen Hathaway High School students came back from a field trip with what appears to be a sunburn. The mystery is the students and teachers don't know what caused it.
We have no idea.
It's very bizarre. It's something that we need to be really concerned about.
Grasping at straws, trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together.
The first stop on the field trip was a school conference in rain at the Civic Center. But only Hathaway High School students had these burn symptoms.
It looked more like a flash burn or something that someone would experience inside of a tanning bed.
The students then stopped at a fast food restaurant in Crowley before heading home. School officials say it could have been the lighting, allergic reactions, or even chemicals.
Something caused it, and I'd like to know what it was.
But right now, they just don't know. In Hathaway, Sean Klein, KATC.
Our last couple BioWars EnviroHealth updates. An article on grist.org that's a response to an article that everyone's favorite Tina Fey wrote in The New Yorker about whether or not to have a second child. So the grist.org article is called, "Hey Tina Fey, One Kid is Okay." And greener, too. I'll remind you again of one of the most recent videos from youtube.com/Corbett Report, the last word on overpopulation. And I shouldn't have to tell you that Tina Fey and the show 30 Rock, which is short for Rockefeller, is such an amazing source of phony environmental propaganda. You should watch an episode once in a while. Meanwhile, from Top News 360, monarch butterflies make a partial comeback in Mexico. That was one I saw flipping through the newspaper while on break at work, and I use my little Wi-Fi pod to make little notes of news articles that I see in the Oregonian and the New York Times. That headline struck me. That's a good note, as of course we've seen the disappearance of the bees and all sorts of other mass animal die-offs, but when I see the word monarch, that reminds me of the term for mind-controlled slaves. It's all there in MK Ultra. Our last BioWars EnviroHealth note, girl with 12 fingers and 14 toes aiming for a Guinness record.
When 16-month-old Li Yatimin was born, she came into the world with a little something extra, 12 fingers and 14 toes. Now her family thinks she may be the most digitally enhanced person in the world, and they're hoping to claim a Guinness World Record to prove it. The condition is called polydactylism. but it hasn't kept the toddler from being happy. The mother says we have no difficulties with her. She seems to have a stronger grip on things, so she doesn't drop things as much.
Most of these patients...
The U.S. doctor says people can function normally with extra digits, but many parents choose to have them surgically removed.
From a social standpoint, a lot of people, especially parents, don't want their children to look different. So at a young age, usually anytime after a year of age is when most parents will bring the children in to have it evaluated and then electively chosen to have the extra digit or digits removed.
The Guinness World Record website says two people in India currently hold the record for the most fingers and toes, with 12 fingers and 13 toes each. Brian Thomas, The Associated Press.
Jeez. Sorry, sometimes this show's like a issue of the Weekly World News, is how ridiculous things seem to be. Our drug war update notes first from Redacted News. Argentina accuses U.S. of trying to smuggle weapons into the country. U.S. Air Force C-17 drug mule transport caught smuggling coup-rific spy gadgets, arms, and drugs into Argentina. Relations between the U.S. and Argentina have deteriorated after Buenos Aires lodged a formal complaint over a U.S. military plane that landed late last week carrying guns, drugs, and satellite phones. The Argentinian government claimed the U.S. was trying to sneak the weapons into the country, though it didn't offer an explanation of why Washington might want to do this. The U.S. State Department said the consignment was intended for a police training program in Argentina. Officials from Argentina and the State Department have been in talks aimed at resolving the row. The relationship between the two countries has been poor since Obama released details of a Latin American tour next month that includes Brazil, Chile, and El Salvador, but not Argentina. You have to wonder if he maybe knows something we don't. So that story from my man Jeff Long at Redacted News has a lot of other sources and translated media putting this together, and it's another story where we see someone connected ostensibly to the United States military, but we know it's all been hijacked. Is he another Barry Seal? We'll leave that question as speculation and move to a better story from NewsJunkiePost.com. And again, we're in the drug war headlines, not just CIA covert coups. Pot shop gives free joints for canned food items. A Montana medical marijuana dispensary collected more than a ton of food by offering their members a free joint if they donated canned goods. Robin Phillips of the Happy Farmers family, that's with a PH, in Butte, Montana, said it took the business only a month to collect more than a ton of food and baby items, which will be donated to the Butte Emergency Food Bank. More on that from the Montana Standard. Our last note on drug war updates. Congressman targets federal funding for the war on drugs. This from Raw Story. Colorado Congressman Jared Polis, P-O-L-I-S, has offered two amendments to the House continuing resolution that would eliminate much of the federal funding for the war on drugs in the U.S. The House is currently debating H.R. 1. The full year continuing Appropriations Act of 2011, the bill is needed to fund the government for the rest of the current fiscal year. Representative Jared Polis, Democrat in Colorado, has offered a number of amendments to the legislation. One of his amendments, number 501, would eliminate funding for the Office of National Drug Control Policy, commonly known as the Drug Czar. Another amendment, number 427, would prohibit funds being made available for the investigation or criminal prosecution of any person for the possession, manufacture, or distribution of marijuana. The Marijuana Policy Project is urging its members to contact their representatives about the amendments. This story goes on with some of the support that may or may not be happening for this, and it's just that simple, really. Stop funding it. But that reminds me, in our ongoing outreach program, if you will, of trying to connect with more folks, not only around the world, but in our own Pacific Northwest corner of the world, making contact with some folks up in Washington concerning drug war and other sundry-related things. So look for that in the not-too-distant future. On down the News Purge list, we reach History Mystery with two clips from one story. And perhaps I misspoke. I don't have a clip. I don't have an audio clip. Two stories. Getting into the anthrax conspiracy. New report vindicates the questions. A newly released report produced by a panel of independent scientists asserts that there was not enough scientific evidence for the FBI to convict their prime suspect in the 2001 anthrax attacks, vindicating those who have consistently pointed to a deeper conspiracy behind the case. The $1.1 million report commissioned by the FBI and produced by the National Academies of Sciences concludes that the FBI has overstated the science in its investigation into microbiologist Bruce Ivins, who was identified by the FBI's Amerithrax Task Force as the lone perpetrator of the attacks that killed 5 and infected 17 in the weeks immediately following 9/11. This is next. The report cast doubt on the supposed link between a flask of anthrax found in Ivan's office and letters containing bacterial spores that were mailed to NBC, New York Post, and the offices of Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy. The scientific link between the letter material and the flask number RMR-1029 is not as conclusive as stated in the DOJ investigative summary, this 190-page report states. Although the scientific evidence was supportive of a link between the letters and that flask, it did not definitively demonstrate such a relationship for a number of reasons, said Dr. David Relman, a bioterror expert at Stanford's University of Medicine, who served as vice chair of the review committee. Our overarching finding was that it is not possible to reach a definitive conclusion about the origins of the B. anthracis in the mailings based on the available scientific evidence alone. This shows what we've been saying all along, that it was all supposition based on conjecture, based on guesswork without any proof whatsoever, quote-unquote, Paul Kemp, lawyer who represented Ivins, quoted by the Washington Post. For years, the FBI has claimed scientific evidence for its conclusion that anthrax spores found in the letters were linked to the anthrax bacteria found in Dr. Ivins' lab, said Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa. The report shows that the science is not necessarily a slam dunk. There are no more excuses for avoiding an independent review. Ivins was found dead in 2008 from an apparent suicide at the same time the government was about to indict him. And they brought out all the usual suspects and the talking heads to spin this story once it went massive. People like Gerald Posner, you know, when they roll out guys like that, some type of cover-up is underway. The article we were just reading from goes on, and it is from Steve Watson over on InfoWars. And we do also link to the French Agency Press article, Science Review Cast Doubt on the 2001 Anthrax Case. So if, what was it? I already forget the number. It was like $1 million report. Paltry sum. If we could maybe throw one of those together related to the events of 9/11, maybe we could get more senators and representatives saying, hey, the original report can't possibly be true. And that's what this report is saying. Of course, these are other government guys. They're not going to come out and say, oh, it was a false flag inside job designed to scare the public and to introduce the meme of bioterror, and on and on and on. They're just saying, from a legal standpoint, you didn't really make your case. We're not saying it's a mass conspiracy. We're just saying the official story can't possibly be true. And that's what we say in related to 9/11 and many, many, many other events. So we're halfway through the 220, or rather 217 News Purge. Don't be evil, just be corporate. And we reach the media memes, of which there is no shortage. And of course, this past Sunday, we had the Grammy Awards, which I admit I can't help but watch sometimes, perhaps like a train wreck. I can't turn away. It seems to contain, you know, the best and the worst of everything that I love and hate about mass media and art and music and film and all those things, that whether I'd watch the Oscars or the Grammys or any of those things. Grammys generally make the Oscars look like the Independent Spirit Awards. However, strangely enough, indie band Arcade Fire pulls Album of the Year upset at the Grammys. Now, you might recall back in August of last year when Arcade Fire's new record, The Suburbs, came out, we played a track for you, so you may have heard it first here, and I can even think back to 2004 when their debut, Funeral, came out. I was, of course, still music director at a college radio station. We played the hell out of it back then. How they exactly pulled this off, I'm not sure, but it's fantastic news for Merge Records, an independent label out of Chapel Hill, North Carolina. They also have other great bands like Spoon and the Founders, Superchunk. I think even Teenage Fan Club are on Merge now, and just tons of other great bands. Of course, they've got to have a massive distribution deal with Universal to make sure that an album can be in Walmart and Target and all of those other places to make it even to the point where you're even going to be thought of by the Grammys. But I would say huge props to them, and I looked back in August to see what episode that was, and I would implore you to go back and check out that episode because it also had the Antoine Dodson song. It had the Stephen Slater Take Two Beers and Jump song. If only every episode could be so newsical. That's N-E-W. So let's listen to another track from the Grammy Award-winning band Arcade Fire with Empty Room. Empty Room from the Album of the Year, The Suburbs from the Arcade Fire. Indie band pulls Album of the Year upset. And we're going to continue through our media meme updates. But I will take this moment to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to episode 206 from Media Monarchy. It's February 18th, 2011. My name's James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups, broadcasting live, as always, every Friday morning from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and simulcast by zeropointradio.com and revereradio.net. And a huge thanks to all the other folks who help syndicate and support Media Monarchy. So continuing the media memes with some of our Grammy memes. Interestingly enough now, I'm sure, and I even saw some of them I know, say, who's Arcade Fire? And I'm sure a whole hell of a lot more people said, who's Esperanza Spalding? She is the Portlander who won the Best New Artist Grammy, beating out poor Justin Bieber, also being beat by Arcade Fire in the Album of the Year category. You recall he's that dumb kid we played a clip of last year, not knowing what Germany was. And the Best New Artist Grammy is the Kiss of Death. You should look at, of course, the list of who's won it. It's a who's who of has-beens. So a lot of times you don't actually want that. And if you've never looked at the full list of Grammy categories, it's kind of amazing. You should check out the Best Hawaiian Album and all of the other minutiae. But there's, you know, Best Box Set, Best Liner Notes, and all kinds of interesting things. And actually even the White Stripes, I believe, won the Best Box Set Package Design. The now broken up White Stripes that we heard from last week. Now, of course, we have to mention that the Monarch Madonna of the 21st century, Lady Gaga, lays an egg on the Grammys, crawling out of some bizarre egg thing, and then followed it up by sporting bizarre flesh-colored facial horns when she went on Jay Leno. More on that from Daily Mail and the Associated Press. Eminem got away with dropping an F-bomb at the Grammys. Kenny's Sideshow has some musings. Whether anyone would want to speculate on why a band Muse, who has albums called Harp and The Resistance and sing songs about propaganda and uprising, are given such a massive platform. Our last note on the Grammys, as we're careening through our media memes, is a bizarre story, at least on its face. And on our previous B-side episode, when we were going over the Food World Order updates related to caramel coloring and Coca-Cola, and perhaps doctors wondering if diet soda is linked to strokes, and I speculated that Serene Branson sure probably drinks a lot of Diet Coke, I would wager. Did CBS Grammy reporter have a stroke on air?
Good evening, everyone. I'm Pat Harvey.
And I'm Paul Majors. Country trio Lady Antebellum was the big winner tonight with 5 Grammy Awards. Rapper Eminem, the big shocker, winning only 2 despite 10 nominations. CBS 2's Serene Branson is live at the Staples Center with highlights and backstage coverage we're seeing for the very first time. Serene.
Well, a very, very heavy divertation tonight. We had a very Darrison fight. Let's go ahead, Terrace Chasen, those for the bit. They had the pit.
Did you catch that? This reporter, Serene Branson, apparently had some bizarre senior moment. You can joke that she makes more sense than Miss South Carolina. But there was so much speculation, and people were wondering, what happened to this woman? Is it just a case of nerves? Her doctors are now saying it was just a complex migraine. But the video has gone viral, and of course we always at least need to make at least a passing note to the bizarre things going on in the world of media and memes. And you know a story's hitting a massive level when I go to log in to just check my Yahoo email, and that's the main story. Salacious. Meanwhile, else around the world, from the Mirror tabloid, Cheryl Cole fears her TV deal will turn her into a Stepford wife. Meanwhile, in Detroit, fans are rallying to raise money for a RoboCop statue in Detroit. I believe this started out as the city putting the idea to the citizens, hey, what kind of statue would you want in the town square? And the huge runaway winner was RoboCop, the amazing Paul Verhoeven film of a dystopic Detroit, where see if you can imagine this crazy scenario where a blown out, destroyed city, because all of the manufacturing and real jobs have all been exported, a city completely broke. Its police are private military contractors, and their connections with other scientists and R&D and research and development create RoboCop. I think they've already raised something like $50,000. So, good for them. Put a statue of RoboCop up in Detroit, and it would just be the final, just humorous death knell. We'll close out with a few obituary notes, and again, been catching a lot of these. One, while flipping through the paper at work, and also from a site called Hollywood Memoir. Lynn Lesser, veteran actor and Seinfeld's Uncle Leo, dies at 88. Kenneth Mars, the Nazi buff in the original The Producers, dies at the age of 75. And David F. Friedman, horror film pioneer, the man behind Blood Feast and 2000 Maniacs, passes away at the age of 87. And I suppose, disturbingly enough, that leads us to our next subject heading of murder and mayhem. Four dead after a New York killing spree.
And first up, he is locked up. And tonight we're learning more about the crazed man behind a 28-hour stabbing spree, police say. Let's go to Peter Thorne. He's live tonight in Times Square. Peter?
And 30 hours of violence came to a bloody and dramatic end here at the subway station behind me. We're on 40th Street and 7th Avenue here in Manhattan, a stone's throw from Times Square. From unemployed graffiti artist and crack user to homicidal maniac, that's the picture police painted earlier today of the man whose murder rampage was only ended by three heroic police officers who risked their lives to take him down.
Takedown. Maxim Gelman in custody tonight after nearly 30 hours of bloody violence. Police caught up with the 23-year-old on the Uptown No. 3 train at 40th Street in Manhattan. Gelman sliced the head and neck of a 40-year-old subway rider in what would be his final act of violence in a bloody three-borough knife-wielding rampage.
If he wasn't apprehended this morning, he could have injured and killed many more people.
Gelman's deadly spree started in Brooklyn Friday morning, went through Queens, and reached its dramatic conclusion underground in Manhattan. It triggered a massive and ultimately successful NYPD manhunt. Gelman's accused of stabbing his stepfather, ex-girlfriend, and her mom to death after a fight over using the family car. Carjacking and stabbing a man and using his Pontiac to try to escape, doing the same thing to two other men to get his hands on their cars, fatally running down a pedestrian in the meantime, and finally slashing a man on the subway in the head and neck.
This was a tremendous effort. It was a major investment in seeing to it that this individual was taken off the streets.
Gelman was captured around 9 this morning, and if he is the villain, these are the heroes. Police officers Terrence Howell and Tamara Taylor and off-duty detective Marcelo Razzo. Gelman was on the subway pretending to be a cop and demanding access to the motorman's cab. But the real cops were inside with the motorman. They opened the door, saw Gelman with his knife, and jumped on him as passengers ran for their lives. Police say Gelman has been arrested 10 times before for graffiti and drugs. His most recent drug arrest, they say, was for crack cocaine possession on January 26th.
So did Gelman say anything to police after his arrest, aside from rambling incoherently? Police say he did say this, very chilling. He said, "She had to die." Reporting live tonight from Manhattan, I'm Peter Thorne, PIX 11 News.
And these, unfortunately, are the stories that we see are only growing as we see this mass murder contagion, as we see everything that has been America for the last several generations and more have been systematically destroyed. So you're going to see people essentially losing their minds. I suppose our other murder and mayhem story, while still shocking and sad, seems to be the opposite of our first story, which is just raging murder spree, to a woman dying alone in her cubicle and nobody notices until the weekend.
L.A. County worker apparently died while working in her cubicle on Friday, but no one noticed for quite some time. Dave Meekum live in Downey with more on what happened. Dave.
Been working on this one all day long, gathering a lot of information now. She walked into work Friday morning. Everything seemed fine. Saturday afternoon, another story altogether. Then right over this way, second floor full of cubicles, and that's where they found her.
I came in Saturday to do a little work, and I saw them when they were taking her out.
Exact time of death for 51-year-old Rebecca Wells, still a mystery. But worst case scenario, well over a day after they'd find her. She was hunched over on her desk in her cubicle at L.A. County's Department of Internal Services.
We do know that she was found by a security guard Saturday at about 1 o'clock, unconscious.
Linda Estrada worked with Wells at the county's City Terrace facility. She says the longtime compliance auditor had become a grandmother a week ago and called the USC grad nothing short of enthusiastic.
We all know her right here. Everybody. I don't think anybody even knows.
And the irony there, because just how long Wells would lie slumped over on her desk, as described by workers there this weekend. Detectives, meanwhile, with Downey Police, say the last time a coworker saw her alive, 9 a.m. Friday morning.
She's always working. Always, always working.
So back here to Imperial Highway, county coroner still working this case. They're not ready to say just yet how she died, but nobody believes any sort of foul play, including Downey Police. We'll send it back to you in Hollywood.
So from one extreme to the other, we now move to our Oregon oddities. Now, longtime listeners know I'm born and raised West Virginia boy, lived there for the first 28 years of my life, and have lived the last 5.5 here in the Pacific Northwest. So this next story was one I was never familiar with, although a coworker did mention it to me and said, oh yeah, you should know about that. You'd be really interested in that. So let's get it. From an article by Dave Masco, Rajneesh and his wicked ways revealed on the 30th anniversary of Oregon cult. For a different slant on the world, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh led thousands to a remote area east of Portland for unrestricted sexual activity, communing with UFOs, taking drugs of all kinds, and spiritual excess some 30 years ago in 1981. A group of Portland State University students recently visited the dilapidated ranch in Antelope, Oregon. That's 143 miles east of Portland, to see for themselves why Rajneesh's cult tried to purchase and control this small town back in 1981. What they found were locals who shared memories of nonstop sex and drug parties and where UFO and aliens were invited guests. We didn't find that community of thousands of spaced-out Rajneeshes in their orange robes. We didn't find any of his reported 90 Rolls Royces that he used for daily inspections or to get ice cream. We didn't even find any artifacts that they were either a bronze plaque at the Antelope Post Office that commemorates local resistance to what they called the Rajneeshi invasion, said one Portland student who was writing about the cult's 30th anniversary for local Portland media. As for UFOs, the students found numerous documents written by the Rajneesh that detailed his interest in aliens and his desire to communicate with them because he believed certain areas of Oregon were centers for alien contact. There's still unexplained missing people from Antelope, say locals who also point to murders committed by the Rajneesh followers when he didn't get his own way. That nut really did a number on this town. He almost destroyed it. This story goes on, and I'll just even spell the name for you, Rajneesh, R-A-J-N-E-E-S-H. This article on Hulik.com gets into his wicked ways on this 30th anniversary of this Oregon cult. I was going to mention also, as we were discussing our murder and mayhem, and again, it's everything is related, I watched, I guess, the first hour and a half of the 2-hour-and-40-minute epic known as Zodiac from David Fincher. I also, just last week, saw The Social Network as well. Zodiac is interesting in the way that it's done as far as some of the camera work, and it's just very, it's a police procedure film. And it reminds me of Summer of Sam in a lot of ways, the Spike Lee film about the son of Sam, which also reminds me that the front cover of our own Willamette Week, one of our free weekly alternative papers here in Portland, the Willamette Week at wweek.com, it's a mock-up of the New York Post, and it says, Sum of Sam, S-U-M, as in money, Sum, and the Sam being our own mayor, Sam Adams. But when I saw that staring at me from the newspaper box just a few days ago, I instantly was like, oh my God, that meme is there. These memes are everywhere. Our other Oregon oddity note we noted for you at the top of the show. That's right, the Obamasiah is here in Oregon visiting Intel, the microprocessor, semiconductor, mega plant. And he's appointed the CEO to join his fantastic jobs council that has, I believe, already seen folks like Immelt from GE and all of those, you know, great, great guys. Corporatism is alive and well, and that's what Mussolini said fascism should really be called. We'll close out the news purge alphabetically, as always, with West Virginia worry. Senator Manchin says Obama budget falls short, and it's not what the country needs or expects. Both of those stories from thehill.com. And our last note from Examiner, U.S. Marshal killed on duty. He was only 24 years old and joined the academy over just a year ago. Three U.S. Marshals were attempting to serve an arrest warrant and open fired, and one guy was killed. And this seems to be the war against all of us, the war against the cops, the war against the people, the war against the crime, and left, right, Tea Party, all of these things coming to some kind of bizarre head. Our lead story on the latest NewWorldNextWeek.com episode concerns the disturbing story of Laura Logan, the CBS reporter apparently raped in Cairo, and now the resulting tabloid aftermath in the corporate media now has even seemed to turn into a full-blown sexual abuse meme. But do these real stories, are they celebrity stories? Do they distract from what is really maybe the institutional violence that goes all around and goes underreported? So we have links for you on the tale of Laura Logan. And we do have one clip to set this up for you from ITN News.
U.S. broadcasting network CBS has said that one of its correspondents, Laura Logan, was beaten and sexually assaulted by a mob while she covered the jubilation in Cairo's Tahrir Square on the day Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak stepped down. The 39-year-old South African and longtime war correspondent, seen here at the funeral of a former cameraman who was killed in Baghdad during the U.S. invasion, is recovering in hospital in the United States. She was said to have been separated from her crew moments after this picture was taken, then surrounded and subjected to a brutal sexual assault and beating before being saved by a group of women and Egyptian soldiers. According to media watchdog, the Committee to Protect Journalists, at least 52 journalists were attacked and 76 imprisoned during the unrest in Egypt that led Mubarak to step down after 30 years in power. The committee also said one journalist, Ahmed Mohamed Mahmoud, who worked for an Egyptian newspaper, was killed while filming the clashes near Tahrir Square.
So this story then surrounds all the other talking heads and how the story turns into talking about how we're talking about the story and not the actual matters of the case. So one guy near Rosen made offensive tweets and he was fired and then had to go on a contrition appearance with Anderson Cooper because he was saying, oh, you're trying to outdo Anderson Cooper. And of course, if you grew up watching Channel 1 like I did, you know, you can't outdo Anderson Cooper and his Vanderbilt heirs. And Bill Maher saying we'd trade the intrepid hotness of Laura Logan and we'll send you one of those chicks on The View. And right on the heels of this story, then, Scott Brown, Senator Scott, I drive a truck, Brown, comes out and says he was abused as a child by a camp counselor. But we use these stories as the backdrop to try and shine a light on something that doesn't get as much coverage. Veterans say rape cases mishandled. Pentagon sued for mishandling sexual assault complaints. More than a dozen U.S. veterans who say they were raped or assaulted by comrades filed a class action lawsuit in federal court Tuesday, attempting to force the Pentagon to change how it handles such cases. The current and former service members, 15 women and 2 men, describe circumstances in which servicemen allegedly got away with rape and other sexual abuses while their victims were ordered to continue to serve with them. The suit names Defense Secretary Robert Gates and his predecessor, Donald H. Rumsfeld.
Oh, verbal abuse, sexual assault, even rape by the very soldiers who are sworn to watch your back in combat. And it's not just women coming forward, but men too. And the accusers say their commanders, even the Pentagon, knew about these attacks, but just didn't do enough.
The people who commit these offenses are sexual predators who are very good at selecting their victims and tend to offend again and again. And that is a fact that is not recognized within the DOD system.
Nobody wants to say that there's been a rape in their command. Just looks bad on paper. I know for my case, even not trying to get into specifics, but people who did believe me and who had my back and were supportive of me were still telling me, don't tell anybody about this, don't go to the public.
So now these women are part of a class action lawsuit filed by more than a dozen members of the U.S. military claiming the U.S. Defense Department mishandled their claims and they want change. The lawsuit even names Defense Secretaries Robert Gates and Donald Rumsfeld as defendants. Now listen to these numbers. Last year, more than 2,400 military women openly reported sexual assault. That doesn't include the 900 assaults filed confidentially by women so traumatized they were just afraid to come forward. Well, the Pentagon won't comment on the lawsuit, but Press Secretary Jeff Morrell says that the Pentagon is doing all it can. And while, quote, this is now a command priority, there is clearly still more work to do, end quote. Anu Bhagwati is consulting on the lawsuit. She's the executive director for the Service Women's Action Network. She joins us live in Washington. So, Anu, this makes me think of the military suicides and how that was ignored for so long and the number just grew. Now we're talking about rape and the same type of scenario of just turning a blind eye. Why?
Right. The military has a hard time dealing with systemic institutional failures. In this case, with military rape and sexual assault, we're talking about a systemic failure to protect service members from a hostile workplace environment. As you indicated, this is a problem that affects men and women. We have two plaintiffs that are men, but men actually are under even more stress in reporting than women, in the sense that it's harder to report if you're a man because there's so much gender stigma in the military.
Interesting. Harder for a man to come forward. Well, I mean, and how effective can it come command be when you don't trust that individual standing next to you?
Right. Unfortunately, command discretion is what works in the military. It's a complete failure, though. What you have is commanders adjudicating cases in their own units between a victim and an alleged perpetrator. I mean, this is ridiculous. In the corporate world, a boss would never be adjudicating a criminal case between two employees, but that's what we have in the military. What we need is a third-party system to adjudicate all sexual assault and harassment cases. I mean, in these cases that you'll read in this complaint, I mean, they're egregious cases in which victims were both sexually harassed, sexually assaulted, physically brutalized, psychologically tortured by their perpetrators. The commanders knew about this and oftentimes ignored the case altogether, forced the victim to work alongside her or his perpetrator to live with, to be under the supervision of their perpetrators. I mean, these are really egregious cases, and I hope the American public is outraged when they find out about those.
So again, my friends, we go over this story on the most recent episode from NewWorldNextWeek.com, and we have now all the other related geopolitics and war horrors updates. Colin Powell demands answers over curveballs, weapons of mass destruction lies. That's right, the Iraqi defector curveball admits to the WMD lies that led to war.
The source was an eyewitness, an Iraqi chemical engineer who
supervised one of these facilities. He actually was present during biological agent production runs. He was also at the site when an accident occurred in 1998.
The Iraqi Colin Powell is referring to is this man, Rafid Ahmed Alwan al-Janabi, otherwise known as Curveball, a defector who convinced German and U.S. intelligence that Saddam Hussein had a biological weapons program. There was just one problem, as he now admits, for the first time, in an exclusive Guardian interview, he made it all up. Curveball's lies about mobile bioweapons trucks were instrumental in helping George Bush and Tony Blair make the case for war. Although he insists he acted to drive Saddam Hussein from power, many have alleged that he was only telling German intelligence what they wanted to hear in order to influence his claim for asylum.
We knew Curveball was full of it. This is just further documentation, and now he's gone on the record to say as much. That video came from The Guardian, and we have more from Raw Story. The rest of our geopolitics and war horrors updates. Internet explodes as Egypt's dictator finally quits. Mubarak, of course, stepped down last Friday during our live episode 205, but here it is again, put up on the record for you. But further down the list, from Copycat Effect, Egypt's hunt for red mercury. And we ask a few questions. Has there really been an Egyptian revolution if you just put in the torturer in chief? Cryptogon.com asked the question, is Mubarak a Mason? He was doing some research on where the family made their millions, and there it was, a photo with the hidden hand. You've seen it, putting the hand halfway within the coat in a very awkward stance. No one would ever really want to stand that way. The signs and the symbols, just as we mentioned the devil's horns that are on Laura Logan's Wikipedia photo. And then did Mubarak fall into a coma after his final speech? And then did former Tunisian dictator Ben Ali fall into a stroke? Or rather, fall into a coma after a stroke as well? So we see strokes all around, rumored to be strokes. Doctor speculating if diet soda can contribute to a stroke, but I would posit right here that being involved with the Western finance oligarchs and being just a mere pawn on their grand chessboard can have serious health consequences. Meanwhile, teenager finds a priceless ancient sculpture of a pharaoh near a trash can in Cairo. More on that from Refreshing News 9. Meanwhile, Algerian police try to quell Egypt-inspired protest after Mubarak's downfall. That's from the Daily Mail. The Los Angeles Times reporting on military patrolling the streets of Bahrain. And BusinessInsider.com reporting on the ABC journalist now beaten and at least one killed as protests in Bahrain turn violent. And I can turn right now to the breaking news on Google News. Bahrain security forces fire on protesters. Those are all the related geopolitical war horde notes posted up as updates on the bottom of this important story. Amid reporters' assault in Cairo, Pentagon sued over rape cover-up. But back here in the USS of A, House extends key Patriot Act provisions. You may recall last week when we reported for you that the Patriot Act extensions were down but not out. Here from Threat Level, the House voted Monday to extend to December 3 expiring provisions of the Patriot Act spy legislation. The measure's passage by 275 to 144 vote was expected. The three provisions are expiring at month's end. Rather than seriously debate or alter them, the House punted, the third failure by Congress in more than a year to address the law's controversial issues. The measure now goes before the Senate, which, of course, followed the House's course on legislation that was hastily adopted following 9/11. The breakdown on the three provisions. 1. The roving wiretap provision allows the FBI to obtain wiretaps from Secret Intelligence Court, known as the FISA Court, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, without identifying the target or what method of communication is to be tapped. For more on this, we'll turn to allgov.com. Obama Justice Department claims FBI can obtain phone records without warrant or oversight. The names may have changed, but the policy is still the same at the DOJ, where officials under Obama are claiming the government can obtain telephone records without a warrant. The legal position reminds civil libertarians of the controversial stance taken by the Bush administration when it came to collecting intel on its war of terror. Using a federal wiretapping law adopted in 1978 as a loophole, the FBI is asserting that it can review telephone records of international calls made from the United States without any formal legal process or court oversight. This according to McClatchy newspapers. And this all coming out with the wash, as they say. The second one, the lone wolf measure allows FISA court warrants for the electronic monitoring of a person for whatever reason, even without showing that the suspect is an agent of a foreign power or a terrorist. The government has said it's never invoked that provision, but the Obama administration said it wanted to retain the authority to do so. For more on this, we can turn to the Associated Press. For a story from June 13, 2009, shootings show threat of lone wolf terrorists. Three chilling cases share similar pattern of a killer acting alone. One of these, of course, is the Tiller killer and the Holocaust shooter, Von Braun. And we reported extensively on all those stories as they relate to homegrown errorism. But the third provision, the business records provision, allows FISA court warrants for any type of record from banking to library to medical without the government having to declare that the information sought is connected to a terrorism or espionage investigation. For more on that one, we hop to Bloomberg. House passes short-term extension of terror wiretap authority. But that doesn't exactly break down the business records aspect. You'll have to do more research on that for yourself. But posted below this story, that should be no surprise. We've told you Obama has continued the Bush state of emergency after 9/11 again and again. He's two for two in his 2 years in office of extending the continuity of government operations put into place. So we have the link to the story of last week when the Patriot Act was down but not out. But below that, we have all the other related police state updates from alternet.org. U.S. Chamber of Commerce thugs use terror tools for disinfo scheme, and that's what happens. Everybody gets their little boss hog corner of power, and they're going to abuse it because people like to get into positions of power so they can abuse their cronies and tickle their proclivities, if you will. Anti-terror message pitched to the NBA. More on that from My Fox NY. TSA criminals caught stealing cash and arrested for assault. More on that from InfoWars and a bizarre video from Japan that you should watch animating the story of TSA criminals caught stealing cash. Meanwhile, mice trained by Israeli scientists could be coming very soon to an airport security zone near you. More on that from The Telegraph. Meanwhile, the Lancashire Telegraph .co.uk doomsday terror attack simulation in Lancashire. But back here in the North American Union, Mexican troops conducting vehicle searches on U.S. soil.
Well, armed men wearing Mexican Army uniforms operating in the U.S. It's all caught on camera. Channel 5's Paula Sandoval was first to bring us a video of an apparent incursion at a Valley International Bridge. Tonight, he digs deeper into what U.S. authorities want done about it.
Surveillance cameras caught it all. 10:43 a.m. A large green military transport vehicle crosses the international boundary on the Anzaldúa's international bridge. A dozen armed men aboard have crossed into American territory. They travel nearly the entire U.S. stretch of the bridge. The driver stops just before reaching the U.S. Customs checkpoint. They make a U-turn and go back south. Here you see the vehicle stop, then pull off the road. A look from another angle reveals the men have stopped a couple aboard an SUV. They search the vehicle, even open the trunk, all on U.S. soil. They call the search off and continue their trek south, the SUV following close behind. The U.S. Customs checkpoint is less than a mile from where I'm standing right now. This is the rest stop where the search you just saw took place. Clearly, we're in the United States. You look to my left, that concrete over there, well, that's a border wall levee. Just south of that is the floodway.
We're unsure whether or not they were clearly aware that they crossed into the United States, but it appears that it's quite obvious that they had.
Mission Police Chief Leo Longoria's officers patrol this bridge. He believes the men were Mexican military.
We hope that if it was them, that we applaud their efforts, but that they at least coordinate those approaches, particularly coming into the United States.
Longoria expects to know if Mexican authorities are working in his jurisdiction.
We recognize that we're trying to work as hard as we can to curtail the drug violence and so forth, but we try to help each other out, and when we come across those type of situations, we clearly try not to cross the international boundaries.
10:52 a.m. The men drive back across the boundary. They're on U.S. soil for less than 10 minutes. This wouldn't be the first incursion by the Mexican military. These photos were snapped west of the valley last year. Mexican Marine helicopters hovering in U.S. airspace. U.S. officials confirmed Mexico had no permission to cross the border then. Police and Channel 5 News contacted Mexican authorities about this crossing. They insist it didn't happen.
Now, did you happen to catch the substitution? Instead of saying the word border, he used the word boundary. But, I must be crazy. I just must be thinking like a civilian. I'm not a citizen, I'm a civilian. There aren't borders, there are boundaries. They're not laws, they're policies. Euphemistic language. So, Mexican troops conducting vehicle searches on U.S. soil, Mexicursion, if you will. Meanwhile, again from Redacted News, major false flag gone awry, or just more tiresome scarerism. A weapon of mass destruction was found in the U.S., the shock confession of a customs officer.
Strong reaction tonight to the interview in which San Diego's assistant port director told 10 News that weapons of mass destruction have been found in San Diego. iTeam reporter Mitch Blocker showed the unedited interview to a nationally recognized security expert.
Former Secret Service agent and airline security director Glenn Wynn watched the unedited interview.
This person was, I believe, knowledgeable. Has a very important position with the port and with the government, and as such, has that knowledge.
He watched San Diego's assistant port director, Al Haller, answer questions about weapons of mass destruction.
Do you ever find things that are dangerous? I mean, like a chemical agent or weaponized device?
At the airport seaport, at our port of entry, we have not this past fiscal year, but various our partner agencies have. Hot items like that.
We would ask Haller directly if his agency had ever found WMDs.
You ever found them?
Not at this location.
But they have found them.
Yes.
The Department of Homeland Security says Haller was nervous and simply misspoke. They told us they've not specifically had any incidents with nuclear devices or nuclear materials at our ports of entry. When asked about chemical agents and weaponized devices, Haller said this.
Our partner agencies have hot items like that.
But my anxiousness of it is, all right, if you did find them, what'd you do with them?
Where are they?
Where are they? I mean, and, you know, again, we need to let the public know so they can be on alert to that.
While the Department of Homeland Security wouldn't confirm what Haller said, they did reiterate that a nuclear device has never been found here in the U.S.
Well, as Glenn points out, there's obvious questions to be answered, and as he says, just to say misspeak doesn't really answer those questions.
That is a valid point, but that is what the Department of Homeland Security says he did, that he was nervous, that he misspoke. Now, what is interesting is the security expert we talked to, Glenn Wynn, brought up the point that actually telling people where some of these things were discovered, what they were, might actually lead to a little bit more vigilance. The people, if they're driving around, could be more vigilant in areas if they see something, if they notice something.
And this is obviously a guy who's in a position of authority. He should know.
That's what Glenn Wynn says.
Yeah.
So was he nervous and just misspoke, or have they found weapons of mass destruction? Did you just misspeak? Did Watson really crash, or was it just the back end? Furthermore, down the police state updates, no charges, of course, because cops can mow down seemingly anyone they want and get away with it. Like they've got the 007. No charges against Seattle officer who killed a wood carver. More on that from the Seattle Times. But as long as we're in Washington, from KREM.com, I'm a suicide bomber. Report of bomb on Spokane-bound train was, of course, a drunken hoax.
A bomb threat forced the evacuation of a Spokane-bound Amtrak train overnight.
More than 100 passengers spent the night sleeping on the floor of a middle school in Browning, Montana. That's where the train stopped so authorities could investigate. They didn't find a bomb, but did take a man on board into custody.
Crimson's Othello Richards talked to some of the passengers.
He was sitting kind of by us, and he kept on going by, and he was just belligerently drunk. So he started a fight with another passenger earlier and should have been kicked off the train and wasn't.
Michael Hart says that happened at the Amtrak stop just before Browning, Montana. Other passengers say the man continued his unruly antic. They say the crew eventually threatened to take him off.
We were about 2 miles east of Browning, city of Browning, when this happened. The guy raised his backpack up and says, I've got a bomb here. I'm a suicide bomber.
Ronald Dirksen says at the Browning station, police grabbed the man and took him off the train. He says it found no bomb in his backpack. The train left the station. Just minutes later, it stopped.
I understand that he said, told the cops in the car, I got the bomb on the train, not my backpack.
All of a sudden, you see 12 cop cars flying towards the train in the middle of a field, and everybody's like, what's going on?
Authorities tell us the FBI stopped the train. They evacuated about 150 passengers and took them to a nearby middle school. We're told agents scoured the train for explosives, but didn't find anything. Passengers tell us bomb-sniffing dogs checked each of their bags at the school.
8 hours later, we finally get it back on the train and get going again.
The train stopped in Spokane, but instead of finishing its trip west, it turned around. Passengers were put on buses, told the train was behind schedule. Hart chose to rent a car instead.
Bus just isn't for me.
Same for Dirksen. He will spend the night in a hotel and finish his journey to Everett, Washington, Wednesday. Back on the rail.
I think the crew should have taken this guy off the train before Browning. This, none of this would have happened.
Now, passengers we talked to tell us that nobody seemed really angry. They all were just extremely tired. Reporting live with fellow Richards Crimpton.
So watch as all the homegrown errorism focus shifts to the rails. While we're still in Washington, we have more on a story that we have been covering and at least mentioning to you since it happened. Scant other coverage exists. However, in this case, let's take it from the New York Times. In Spokane, a mystery with no good solution. The bomb was sophisticated and potentially deadly, but it did not detonate. No one was hurt, and no one has been arrested. So Spokane became a mystery. To me, it's that God's gracious hand moved, said Chief Ann Kirkpatrick of the Spokane Police Department. This was a bomb of significance that would have caused devastation. Nearly a month after a cleanup crew found the live bomb along the planned route of a large downtown march honoring the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the FBI is investigating the incident as an act of domestic terrorism, and Spokane has cycled from shock to relief to reassessment. Have the white supremacists who once struck fear here in the inland Northwest returned to a new level of dangerousness and sophistication? We don't have that kind of intelligence level to make that kind of explosive, said Sean Winkler, a Pennsylvania native who recently returned to the region to start a landscaping company and a chapter of the Ku Klux Klan. Mr. Winkler lives not far from Hayden Lake, Ohio, where he was once among the followers of Richard Butler, white supremacist and Aryan Nations leader who spent more than two decades proclaiming the inland Northwest to be the capital of a new white homeland. Butler died in 2004 after losing the 20-acre Aryan Nations compound in a lawsuit and losing many of his followers as well. The Pacific Northwest has been, in not too many years past, the hotbed for neo-Nazi, white supremacist, Aryan Nation activity. So that's the MLK Day bomb update, and our last note comes from The Guardian again. Jihadi who helped train 7-7 bomber freed by the U.S. after just 5 years. The release prompts claim Islamist was U.S. informant while assisting London terrorist, an American jihadist who set up the terror training camp where the leader of the 2005 London suicide bombers learned how to manufacture explosives, has been quietly released. After only serving 4.5 years of a possible 70-year sentence, a Guardian investigation has learned, the unreported sentencing of Mohammed Junaid Babar to time served because of what a New York judge described as exceptional cooperation that began even before his arrest has raised questions over whether Babar was a U.S. informer at the time he was helping to train the ringleader of the 7-7 tube and bus bombings. Lawyers representing the families of victims and survivors of the attacks have compared the lenient treatment of Babar to the controversial release of the supposed Lockerbie bomber, Al Megrahi. Babar was imprisoned in 2004, although final sentencing was deferred after pleading guilty in New York to 5 counts of terrorism. He set up the training camp in Pakistan where Mohammad Sadiq Khan and several other British terrorists learned about bomb making and how to use combat weapons. Babar admitted to being a dangerous terrorist who consorted with some of the highest-ranking members of Al-Qaeda, providing senior members with money and equipment, running weapons, and planning 2 attempts to assassinate Musharraf. But in a deal with prosecutors for the U.S. Attorney's Office, Babar agreed to plead guilty and become a government supergrass in return for a drastically reduced sentence. Another case of Fed and Intel-connected informants prodding and fostering and training patsies for an attack that seems to flip live without their awareness. Those are your police state updates, all posted to the bottom of House Extend's key Patriot Act provisions. And we'll turn to our final post on Media Monarchy and for this show. But we pack a lot in for Obamasiah and Econo Crash. And as we've said, I can feel the tremor in the force. The Obamasiah is here in Oregon today, in Hillsboro, visiting the Intel plant. You can read into those words any way you'd like. Obamasiah releases $3.73 trillion budget. Phony partisan squabbling begins. We'll add in the little sidebar that as tax revenues drop, U.S. borrows 40 cents of every dollar spent. But back to the budget. From the intelligence-connected Voice of America, one key reason that Obama, his Dem allies in the Congress, and rival Republicans are squabbling over the budget is that the budget deficit is expected to hit its highest level in decades. Newly published budget documents say the deficit is forecast to hit 10.9% of the GDP in 2011. Many economists say deficits above 3% are not sustainable.
President Barack Obama released Monday his plans to drastically cut federal spending with a proposed $3.73 trillion budget for fiscal year 2012. The proposal will reduce the national deficit by more than $1 trillion over a 10-year period, 75% of which will be accounted for by spending cuts, tax increases, or doing away with existing tax breaks. The Obama administration estimates that reducing or cutting 200 federal programs will save $33 billion in 2012 alone. Obama said, quote, "My budget makes investments that can help Americans win this competition and transform our economy, and it does so fully aware of the very difficult fiscal situation we face." Obama also said that the programs that would be cut under the new budget include, quote, "many whose mission I care deeply about, but meeting our fiscal targets while investing in our future demands no less." The president is calling for a 5-year non-security discretionary spending freeze and a 2-year freeze of federal government employee salaries. Despite the reductions, Obama's budget still falls short of the $4 trillion in savings recommended by a White House deficit commission because it offers little change to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security programs. It also fails to measure up to the $62 billion Republican leaders are pushing to slash in the remaining 7 months of fiscal year 2011, with more cuts in fiscal 2012. Republican lawmakers are also criticizing Obama for failing to outline plans to reduce entitlement spending. However, the budget acknowledged that cuts to discretionary spending are only the beginning to remedying the country's fiscal problems, reading, quote, "But non-security discretionary spending represents approximately 12% of all spending. The solution to our long-term fiscal problems cannot rest on this alone." Obama is looking to create long-term growth through investments on innovative technology research and development and education. The budget will create 100,000 teaching positions in science, math, technology, and engineering over the next 10 years. Under the proposed budget, the national deficit would decline from its projected 10.9% of GDP in fiscal 2011 to 2.9% by fiscal 2018. Economists, for the most part, agree that a deficit lower than 3% of GDP is sustainable.
So if all that crazy economics talk is kind of tough to wrap your head around, just know that it's all a bunch of Wall Street-connected Congress critters squabbling over the bits for their districts and not doing really what their constituents would want them to do. If that all seems just a little too economics and boring, let's take it from Wall Street down to Main Street for something that's a little more tangible. Borders Books bankrupt.
Number two U.S. bookstore chain Borders filed for bankruptcy here in New York today. After management changes, job cuts, and debt restructuring efforts failed, the company will now shut 30% of its stores and look to restructure with $505 million in financing from lenders led by GE Capital. Here to discuss the company is Michael Norris, senior analyst for Simba Information. He's a publishing industry research consultant and editor of Simba's book publishing report industry newsletter. He joins us from Stamford, Connecticut. Welcome to Bloomberg. Bottom line, thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
What are the ripple effects of this? This is not just about Borders, is it?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, a lot of people really want to chalk off what happened to Borders as kind of a victory in the ebook column. But the truth is, a lot of things have been going wrong with Borders for quite a while. And there's actually been a perfect storm of missteps that have occurred since about 10 years ago on up.
So what are some of those missteps?
Well, the first and most obvious one I can think of is in August of 2001, Borders offered e-commerce services through Amazon.com, which was basically an affiliate agreement, and that basically allowed Borders to collect, you know, money from having a website without actually having to invest in it themselves. Now, you can make all of the, you know, fox in the hen house jokes that you want, but the bigger issue besides having Amazon control Borders' online presence is Borders didn't get to control the relationship with the consumer. So right. For about 6+ years, a lot of tech-savvy shoppers went to Borders, ended up, you know, being linked to the Amazon site, and Borders basically cut itself out as its own middleman. So they lost a lot of ground when that happened. When George Jones took over Borders in 2006, he immediately saw what kind of a problem that was, so he tried to move to correct it. But
right.
By that time, it was really the bar had been set so high for internet service, they really struggled to keep up.
Bankrupt boundaries. Oh, I mean Borders. So further down our related economic crash updates, a delusioned, or rather disillusioned, 99er shares his disappointment with the American dream and welcomes death in a disturbing letter published on ZeroHedge.com. Meanwhile, TalkingPointsMemo.com reporting on South Carolina may adopt their own currency. And up to New York, where this story caught my eye in the newspaper, a legal manual for an apocalyptic New York. Major disasters like terrorist attacks and mass epidemics raise confounding issues for rescuers, doctors, and government officials. They also pose bewildering legal questions, including some that may be too painful to consider, like how the courts would decide who gets life-saving medicine if there are more victims than supplies. But courts, like fire departments and homicide detectives, exist in part for gruesome what-ifs. So this month, an official state legal manual was published in New York to serve as a guide for judges and lawyers who could face grim questions in another terrorist attack, a major radiological or chemical contamination, or a widespread epidemic. quarantines, the closing of businesses, mass evacuations, warrantless searches of homes, the slaughter of infected animals and the seizing of property, when laws can be suspended and whether infectious people can be isolated against their will or subjected to mandatory treatment. It's all there. In dry legalese in the manual published by the state court system and the State Bar Association, with the handy-dandy PDF link for you to download this report and read about the quarantines and the mass evacuations that have all been codified and laid out for you in advance. Our last note on the EconoCrash updates, asking the question, as Wisconsin shuts government down, are Americans finally reacting to economic rape? This would go back to the story that's on the breaking news on the front pages. Wisconsin protests continue against union bashing. So that story's raging around as we just connect dots and see dominoes falling. Posted below, even the EconoCrash updates are all just the other related and sundry updates from some of our Congress critters, some we love and some we hate. And here we have, again, second year in a row, Dr. Ron Paul wins the Conservative Political Action Committee presidential straw poll by a huge margin, beats the other fake conservatives, Mormon Romney and Palin and all the other folks. And, interestingly enough, Fox News got busted with their ham-fisted attempt to put the 2010 footage of Ron Paul being booed and act like it was from this year's event. So, all the phony left-right partisanship, we're only going to see more of it because we're already going to head back into the bread and circus selection season for 2012. So we referenced the seeming sexual abuse meme that exploded related to Laura Logan and also the lawsuits against the Pentagon for their cover-up of rape and sexual abuse. Here it is again, as we briefly referenced for you before. Senator Scott Brown says he was abused by a camp counselor as a child. The Boston Globe reporting on Justice Clarence Thomas and his record-breaking silence on the bench for 5 years. He's never said a word. Just looks bored and looks at his watch. We'll close it all out with a story that Raw Story just kind of simply calls Hillary heckled during speech. But more specifically, it was veteran and former CIA analyst Ray McGovern who was beaten, bloodied, bruised, and arrested for merely standing silently with his back to the one and only Hillary as she smiles and talks about Egyptian rights abuses.
So this is America.
The government.
This is America. Who are you?
To communicate with each other. And it did not want the press to communicate with the public.
So there you have it. As Secretary of State Hillary Clinton gave her speech at George Washington University condemning governments that arrest protesters and do not allow free expression, 71-year-old Ray McGovern was grabbed from the audience in plain view of her by police and an unidentified official in plain clothes, who you heard Ray there saying, "Who are you?" brutalized and left bleeding in jail. She never paused while speaking. When Clinton began her speech, Mr. McGovern remained standing silently in the audience and turned his back. So this is no nut job, 9/11 truther, crazy person. This is CIA analyst for 27 years, veteran Army officer. Wearing his Veterans for Peace t-shirt, this post that we've just been reading for you from justiceonline.org shows the photos of Ray with his Veterans for Peace shirt on and the massive beating and bruises that he sustained. So this is America. There you have it, my friends. All the alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups that your little heart can handle. We'll make a brief mention of our now quite active Twitter feed on twitter.com/MediaMonarchy. We cover tons of things there that we may never even really get into here on the show, such as the Chilean miners smoked pot underground and seven reasons why the left will eventually turn to eugenics again from the Telegraph, and more, all on twitter.com/MediaMonarchy. So, my friends, I'll once again remind you, as I did at the top of the show, your support helps keep Media Monarchy going and growing. Please give a donation, hit the button at the top of the page, and we can keep this growing and getting bigger and sharing this information and making more connections all around the world. My name is James Evan Pilato. I am your host and webmaster of the site and show at MediaMonarchy.com. This has been episode 206 for February 18th, 2011. And we end, as we always end, by reminding you, don't hate the media. Become the media. Take care.
MediaMonarchy.com is your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Featuring weekly radio shows on the Portland Radio Authority, PRAradio.org, the New World Nextweek video series with CorbettReport.com, plus special interview episodes, B-sides, mixtapes, and so much more. Send news tips to MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. You can make a donation or mail media to the Monarchy at P.O. Box 12165, Portland, Oregon 97212. Thanks to all the internet and community radio stations who broadcast these shows, and most of all, thanks to you. Remember, don't hate the media, become the media.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.